This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In New York, the six-month, multi-million-dollar trial of two former Tyco executives hangs on the edge because of one dissenting voice. Juror number four is apparently a lone vote holding out for acquittal, and the other jurors are upset. Notes passed to the judge last week described the mood in the jury room as poisonous. After a weekend that was supposed to be a cooling-off period, the judge today considered a defense motion for a mistrial. Few of us have ever sat on a jury with so much at stake, but a jury duty summons is an inevitable part of civic life. So many of us know the strange experience of working with 11 strangers to decide another stranger's fate. In the jury room, the noble idea of a jury of one's peers often comes down to personal dynamics and a crash course in the legal system. If you've been involved in jury deliberations, call and tell us what it was like. Was a decision reached easily or was it drawn out? What kind of instructions did you get about how jurors need to work with each other? And what do you wish that you had been told? Call us with your experiences. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from New York is Andrew Ross Sorkin, a business reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the Tyco trial for the entire 6 months. He's at a phone booth across the street from the courtroom. Thanks very much for taking the time to join us today.
How are you, Neil?
Very well, thanks. Where does the case stand now?
Well, you know, we all thought this was headed towards a mistrial this morning. The defense made several motions for the mistrial, citing all of the publicity surrounding this case and the identification of juror number four, which I'm sure we'll get into in a bit. But the judge came back and said that he thought they could continue deliberating. He has done an interview with juror number four, who is the one at issue, and she apparently has said she does not feel like she's been influenced by all whatever these outside forces are, so to speak, and that she's prepared to move forward. He is obviously trying to save this case, the judge. We've been in this for 6 months, and I think he doesn't want to let it go to a hung jury at this moment.
All right. Well, reel us back to last week. What came out first about juror number four? How did we find out about her?
Well, it was the big moment last Friday. Pretty dramatic. We knew that there was a dissenting juror from some earlier notes that the jury had sent out to the judge that had said that the room had turned poisonous, that there were incendiary remarks made to each other, but we didn't know exactly who it was. There was some inclination, I think, among spectators that juror number four, who had been nodding throughout the trial with a lot of things the defense had said, might be it. But on Friday, she walked out and gave this, I almost have to describe it as a bizarre okay hand signal, you know, touching her thumb to her forefinger and in the direction of the defense, and then almost trying to camouflage it as she walked past the prosecution by rubbing her hair. And we didn't really know what to make of it. Everyone kind of sat there saying, did you just see that? Did that really just happen? And obviously, over the weekend, the papers and the radio and TV have picked up on it, and it's become almost an issue inside and outside of the court.
Well, and she has been named. There was a front page sketch of this juror on the front page of one of the New York tabloids labeled Ms. Trial over the weekend. But I guess she was described at least in one of the tabloids as a batty blue blood.
Right.
So, you know, this is all coming out. And I guess the defense motion today was based on the idea that even though jurors have been told not to pay any attention to any media coverage, it's hard to ignore the front page of what the New York Post.
Exactly. The big issue is that the journalistic convention has long been that the press does not report on who the jurors are, what their names are, and in terms of singling them out because of the possible influence it can have on them. The Wall Street Journal ran her name and her number on Friday first.
Her number as juror number four, not her phone number.
No, not her phone number. No, exactly. Just her number, the juror number four number. I think the New York Post, at some level, tried to use the journal as cover and also published the name. So far, we have yet to do so, and I know a number of news organizations have not. But that has become another issue circling this little mini circus over here.
So as you look at this, presumably you have 11 votes. Let me say, is this perception correct? There are 11 jurors ready to vote for at least some guilty verdicts, and we'll get back to the defendants and what they're actually charged with in a moment, too. But there are 11 people apparently ready to vote for some kind of conviction, and she is the one holding out and, according to the other jurors, not willing to deliberate in good faith.
Well, that's what they're saying. It appears it's a little less clear than that even. It appears that she has decided, for whatever reason, that she doesn't want to deliberate anymore, and that, or, by the way, let's just say this is what she had decided earlier, because clearly now they are deliberating and apparently trying to deliberate in good faith. But what had happened up until Friday was that she had, I think, kind of gotten herself in a corner and said, listen, I don't think that these men are guilty of any of the charges. And I think she had a hard time with the issue of criminal intent, whether these men thought they were doing wrong at the time that they were doing it, which is the requirement. And I think that there are others, and let's just say, not all 11, we're unclear that all 11 are ready to convict on all the charges, but
mm-hmm.
some of them at least are ready to convict on some. But obviously, if one person shuts down, it effectively shuts down the process.
And let's get back, before we get to the case itself, to the OK sign that she apparently flashed to the defendant's bench there. You saw it. Are you convinced that it was some sort of a signal to the defense?
It was clear. Night and day. I mean, I had my eyes on her. I had suspected that she was the juror. There was a number of people who were watching very closely, and there was some kind of signal there of some sort. It was bizarre and clearly quite strange, but there's no doubt that something was going on there.
Could the judge see it? Because I gather in his earlier today, he said, well, she may have just been brushing her hair.
No, the judge couldn't see it. She was directed kind of the opposite way towards the defendant's table and did this with her right hand, if you can kind of imagine how that might be. The defense was the one actually today who suggested that they didn't see it or they were unclear what it was. And I think to those who were paying attention, we all kind of questioned that. It's pretty clear what was going on.
Now, all of this about a juror, number four, we're sort of leaving off the lead here, and that is that former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski and his former finance chief Mark Swartz are accused of looting their company.
Exactly. Exactly. Both of these men are charged with basically taking payments, paying themselves money, by hiding them in bonuses and doing all this without the approval of the board. And by the way, let me be clear. There has been a lot of damning evidence throughout that many of the board members have said, we don't know about this. We didn't know anything. We never approved any of this stuff. On the flip side, they had auditors come on, come to the stand and say, we knew about it. It was in the documents. We gave it to the audit committee. They knew about it. And so it really did create a lot of confusion about whether these gentlemen are guilty or not.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, thank you very much. I guess the jury is, as you said, back deliberating, and we'll see how long that lasts.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Andrew Ross Sorkin is a business reporter for The New York Times. He's been covering the Tyco trial for the entire 6 months, and he was at a phone booth across the street from the courtroom where it's going on. Well, joining us now from our bureau in Chicago is Paul Liznick. He's a trial lawyer, a jury consultant, and the author of the book The Hidden Jury, and it's good to speak with you.
And it's good to be back.
How common is it for a development like this to happen? I mean, not necessarily all the dramatics, the signal to the defense, perhaps, but for one juror to hold out.
You know, you may remember the movie, The 12 Angry Men, which, of course, is about one lone juror. What makes that a great movie?
Henry Fonda.
Yeah. Henry Fonda, exactly. And actually redone just a few years ago with some others. I don't remember who. But anyway, the point is that's the stuff that fiction is made out of. We don't typically see one juror holding out. And I'll tell you why, Neil, is because the dynamics of jury deliberation tell us that one juror is far more likely to give in to the pressures of the others simply because they stand alone. Now, if juror number four was able to get some other juror to join her in this mission, that would be unstoppable. But the fact that she's holding out on her own, that's pretty unusual and pretty rare, even as the world of group dynamics goes.
Group dynamics besides, what about the judge? Does that person have any capability to respond to these problems?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, what the judge has available, he's not used this opportunity yet. He can give what's known as an Allen charge. Sometimes people call it the dynamite charge, which is he calls the jurors in and he basically says, you know what, get to it. Put his problems aside and get this case handled. He's got to be careful about that because that raises the question of the judge putting a little bit too much pressure on the jurors, and that raises issues on appeal. Allen charges are used very seldomly and very cautiously, but boy, if there was a case designed for one, this could be it.
And remind us what those charges are again?
Oh, well, again, it's called, sometimes called the dynamite charge. It's where the judge brings the jury in and basically says, look, whatever the problem is, you've got a duty to do. I want you to devote yourself to coming to a solution in this case. I don't care what resolution it is, but you work towards a solution. There's been a great amount of time and effort spent here, and I want you to work through the problems. It's basically the mystique of the court and the judge sort of putting this burden, reminding the jurors that they have a duty to try and resolve this matter.
Which I guess is back where this case is right now. Well, we want to get some listeners involved. So if you've served on a jury, call and tell us what your experience was like. We want to find out about the group dynamics inside the jury room. Did one person take charge? Were there factions? Was there loud argument? Or was this a civil discussion? How did you resolve any problems that cropped up? And having had the experience, what do you wish you knew going in? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Robert, who's with us from Burlington, Vermont.
Hi.
Hi.
About 2 years ago, I served on a jury that was deliberating on some domestic abuse cases. It was actually kind of a jury panel. We were on several different trials, on three different trials anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And on both trials that ended up going to the jury, there was... One ended up actually in a holdout where I was not the holdout, but the other one, the first one, I was almost a holdout for not guilty. It was a case where the woman who was cut, she retracted her testimony.
Recanted
her testimony. In fact, she didn't ever really testify. She just told the cops that he cut her.
Uh-huh.
Cops reported that, but she... in the trial, said explicitly that she cut herself. And there wasn't any physical evidence to prove that wrong.
So it seems like you had reason to hold out.
Right, well, yeah, but, you know, the thing is, I mean, it was pretty clear that this guy was kind of a nasty guy.
Well, tell me less about the case than about what was going on in the jury room.
Well, I mean, I was kind of a holdout, and there was a time that I thought that I heard one of her friends, one of her friends testifying about a conversation in the hospital right after she was cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I heard this friend say that she said that she cut herself. And you know, I kept appealing to that issue. You know, like if she told her friend right away that she cut herself, then that really does, you know, kind of contradict what she told the cops that very same night.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so we went back and we listened to the tape, and I actually misheard that. And it was more of a hypothetical, like, if you say this, you know.
I see.
And it sounded more like it was a possibility that they were starting to plan on how to change the testimony. It turned out that the guy, I think it was Talk of the Nation, I called in a couple weeks ago about a three-time loser law, and this guy was getting set up for habitual criminal, and I think that his wife figured that out after she called the cops.
And that would pay some input, obviously, into how they framed it and how, I guess, you guys looked at it as well. But as you hear that story, Paul, what do you think? Does that sound normal?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm struck by when I hear that, which is, and there's lots, of course, now we have our caller here reflecting back on what went on and all of that. But, you know, jurors are supposed to be paying attention to the evidence in the case, evaluating that, which is what this caller told us he did, and looking at it in light of the instructions of law that are given to them. It's interesting when you hear jurors or former jurors comment on what they think strategy is. This guy was being set up for, for the future three strikes and you're out. Now, I don't know whether he was or not, but, you know, that's sort of interesting because jurors should not be getting into that realm, should not be talking about sentencing or other kinds of factors. In fact, I write a lot in The Hidden Jury that jury misconduct, if you will, in the Heidi Fleiss case is what led to a reversal of her verdict when the jurors began to talk about what kind of sentence they wanted her to have and the fact that they actually didn't want her to have any jail time. That was enough to lead to a reversal in that case, the power of juries.
We're talking about jury dynamics, how a dozen strangers work together to determine guilt or innocence. If your experience on a jury was noteworthy, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, totn@npr.org. Back after a short break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about jury deliberations and the stresses and strains that occur among jurors as they try to reach a verdict. If you've sat on a difficult jury, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest is Paul Lisnek, a trial lawyer and jury consultant, the author of The Hidden Jury. And just before the break, Paul, you were telling us about the judge obviously instructs the jury as to the matter of the law. Does the judge give the jury any instructions on how to deliberate?
Wouldn't that be great? No. And, you know, that's one of the problems really in the system is that we don't know how to fix it. Jury instructions themselves, Neil, are not easy to understand. They're confusing. And every time there are studies done to make instructions more comprehensible, well, then they get ambiguous. And so jurors have to do the best they can. You know, if I can, one of the things I find interesting here, I've heard that juror number four in the note she passed back raised the issue of saying, well, you know what? What does it take to prove criminal intent? What if we don't think they had criminal intent? She may be a baddie blue blood, as Andrew Ross Sorkin was telling us, mm-hmm. or then again, maybe she's doing her job. Maybe she's looking at the law and questioning the meaning and looking at the evidence like a juror is supposed to do. She is, from what I understand, a retired lawyer and teacher.
And, of course, we go back to 12 Angry Men when eventually Henry Fonda, the lone holdout, did swing everybody around to his point of view and justice emerged triumphant, or at least a decision was reached, one or the other.
Well, the movie ended.
Yeah. Let's get another caller on the line. This is David, who's with us in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. I was on a jury for a case where a person was accused of groping a woman because of a lurch in the bus,
mm-hmm.
and he had some alcohol, and there was no question that the incident actually happened. The question was whether it was accidental or not.
Intent, again, was the issue, yeah.
And I was not convinced that they had shown that there was intent, but as soon as we got in to deliberate, one person spoke up quickly, and he sort of took over the jury. He
was that person formerly the foreperson of the jury, or just another juror?
He spoke up before we'd even sat down, hardly, and he got himself appointed foreman,
mm-hmm.
and said, "Well, this is just an open and shut case," and everybody went along with it. And there was very little. There was some discussion, but not real discussion of anything other than the fact that the person did it. I didn't buy it. I said so. But finally, after a long time, I finally caved. I thought, well, I shouldn't have, and I feel badly about it.
I can hear that a bit in your voice, David.
Yes. Yeah. But in any case, afterwards, I talked to the judge and told her I felt that, you know, this wasn't quite right. And she said, well, because of the three strikes law, she's going to have to give the guy time.
Right.
And had I known that, I would not have caved.
Yeah. What was it eventually?
I had known.
Yeah, if, but you were in there in the situation in which you were in. What eventually, forced you to say, well, okay, if they're all so convinced, how can I hold out?
Well, I just felt I tried to put out my point of view, but nobody would listen to it.
Uh-huh.
And they, in fact, they were very, I felt sort of a growing antagonism against me.
Mm-hmm. Paul Lisnek, as you listen to what David has been saying, I know that's one thing that jury consultants talk about a lot is trying to identify people who would be leaders in jury deliberations.
That is so true, Neil. And in fact, as I'm listening to David, first of all, you know, lawyers love to take a bet on who they think the foreperson's going to be. And when they can sort of get a sense of it, they're not always right, but they like to play to that person. David confirms for us that here the foreperson created a significant amount of pressure on him and probably other jurors to sort of go a certain way. That doesn't make that right or wrong. It's just one of the dynamics that can happen inside a jury deliberation. He also mentioned that the foreperson sort of appointed himself. Well, there's no rules on how forepersons are appointed. The jurors sit down and sometimes somebody says, hey, I'll be the foreperson. And, you know, they rarely have sort of elections, though one could argue that they should. David, like many jurors, probably looked and said, you know, I can't fight these very powerful dynamics, these very powerful personalities here, and yet here he is also sharing with us, had I only known a little bit more of the consequences, I might have done something differently. But that's the battle of the game. That's why trials are a game, because judges have to decide what jurors are entitled to hear and what they're not allowed to hear.
And what they're allowed to deliberate over, and that's why in a lot of states, even if there are capital murder cases, the guilt is in one phase, and then the sentencing phase, the jury goes back for that.
Well, that's right, because they want to be able to isolate, and they say, look, if now the jurors know it's a death case
right.
In that situation, but it is true. They want to focus and say, you know, is this person guilty of the crime? Has the prosecution met their burden? And if so, then we resort. And by the way, all the dynamics change there. Mm-hmm. You have defense lawyers who go from saying this person didn't do the crime or they can't prove that he did to now coming back after they're found guilty and saying, well, look, you found that he did it. We'll live with that. But let's talk about what mitigating circumstances are that should allow you to produce a second decision. And Scott Peterson, by the way, that's why Mark Garagos, Peterson's lawyer, he asked for a separate jury. I want one jury on guilt and another one on the death sentence, because if you don't do that, these people are more likely to put him to death if they find him guilty. It's an interesting argument. It doesn't carry the day very often.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Here's an email we got. Interestingly enough, I'm not going to identify this person. I'm currently serving on a grand jury, and that's why I'm not going to identify them. It's an interesting and seems to be far less contentious than other juries. The most frustrating jury duty case I was involved in the past was actually a simple DUI case in municipal court. The jury foreman refused to listen to the judge's instructions and adhere to the laws we have to work under and decided that we, as a jury, needed to send a message with a decision I felt was unwarranted in that case. We argued for hours and ultimately could come to no majority decision. It was a frustrating experience that made me realize no jury is truly impartial. A juror may still make a decision based totally on his or her own biases, religious beliefs, or bigotry, and totally disregard the law if so driven. And again, that speaks to the power of the jury foreman.
Well, absolutely. In fact, as I hear you read that, I think in The Hidden Jury, I talk about the fact that fair and impartial is really just a myth. That writer is absolutely correct. Now, by the way, the grand jury situation that he or she is writing from is a little different because there's no judge present there. Basically, there's an argument that prosecutors, and it's all the prosecutors show in a grand jury, can basically get an indictment against a ham sandwich if they try hard enough. It's their forum completely. And so the dynamics are very different in that setting.
Bigger jury usually too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of other people, but generally they're the ones that sort of give the prosecutor the power to move forward. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors will only do that when they're pretty sure they can get the indictments that they're seeking.
Let's talk now with Kathleen, who joins us from Washington D.C.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to call and tell you that I was on jury duty last year, and it was an amazingly profound experience. If I don't sound goofy for saying that, it's you always try to avoid, but in this case, it really was something that sort of demonstrated that democracy, when you really put the rubber on the road, it works.
What happened?
Well, it was a horrible case. It was a vehicular death. Three people were killed, including a young child. And the young man who was charged, obviously what we were trying to determine was it an accident or was he negligent and therefore responsible. And what made it so interesting was the evidentiary part of the trial. You're in the room with the other jurors, but you're not really talking, and you're certainly not talking about the case. And so we had 3 days of evidence, and then when we got together to deliberate, every impression that had been formed about these other individuals had to be revised very quickly. And I don't know if I just had a particularly wonderful group of people, but it was a very civil process. It took us 3 days of very tough deliberations. When we originally polled the jury, we had four guilties, four not guilties, and four undecided. So we sort of started from the smallest amount of consensus you possibly could, and we did manage to get verdicts on two out of the three charges that we were dealing with.
Well, that sounds, civics book.
It was a true civics lesson, and my husband laughed at me because I came home sort of, even though it was a very grueling experience, this was a gruesome situation and very emotional, and the evidence was, there was a lot of graphic evidence and photographs to be dealt with. But this group of people really took the job seriously and really endeavored. It was funny because when we hung on the final charge, the judge, he said to us, normally I would send a jury back in, but based on the questions that you've sent out and the discussions that we've had, it's clear that you've approached this very seriously and done everything that there was to be done. And he let us hang on the one. Probably he wouldn't had if we hadn't come to verdicts on the other two charges.
I wonder, Kathleen, if I could ask, you're told during the case not to discuss the case with any of the other jurors or with anybody else, in fact, and stay away from media and coverage and all of that. Obviously, this is not getting the kind of ink the Tyco case is, but nevertheless, in an emotional, gruesome case, as you describe it, there must be a temptation to lean over to the person next to you and say something.
Well, you know, we, again, I don't know if it was just, the clerk of the court told us we were a somewhat unusual jury, partly because I think we all had that feeling of camaraderie, and it wasn't something you enjoyed, but it was definitely something that made you feel good about the way the American justice system is set up. But we did not. We all took it very seriously. I mean, I certainly don't know what other people were doing when they weren't in the, you know, mm-hmm. in the jury box and in the jury room, but I didn't discuss it even outside. That was one of the things that made it a very difficult few days. And when I finally could come home and say, here was the story, it was a huge relief to sort of get it off my chest.
Yeah.
We also chose our foreperson in a very unusual way because we had a lot of strong personalities, and we decided to pick someone who had been on a jury before, and we only had one person in the room that had been on a jury before, and she was the least likely foreperson.
It's interesting.
She did a great job.
Kathleen, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And as Kathleen's describing a situation, this was just a couple of days, a relatively short case. What happens when you're in something like the Tyco case, which stretches on for 6 months in an evidentiary hearing, and now who knows how long in deliberations?
Well, and what happens is, you know, the jurors bond, and that's clearly what happened in Kathleen's situation. I have to tell you, Neil, I was at a wedding in February and sat at a table of all of the jurors who were on a jury with the bride. They had bonded so much that there they were now at the wedding, and I guess she decided the jury consultant ought to sit with them. But anyway,
I've heard of that in mafia weddings where the never mind, that's a long story.
I watched The Sopranos too. But anyway, I mean, what you have here, you know, and Kathleen was right. People try to get out of jury service all the time. They're constantly trying to get out of it. But when they do it, they find the experience rewarding, satisfying, and they've really accomplished that. And you could hear that in her voice. You know, mm-hmm. that's exactly what happened. I would beg to differ, though. I don't think it's unusual, as the judge or bailiff said to them, you're an unusual jury. Jurors do basically follow the rules. We hear about the times, it seems, when they violate those rules. Pretty much, when they're told not to talk about the case, they don't. Lawyers have the same instruction. Those are pretty critical cases. These long Tyco cases, you know, you're right. Even tougher to not go home and talk to the family. Do some cheat here and there? I'm sure they do. But we hope not in any way as to prejudice the proceedings.
But the temptation to overcome the, you know, I wonder what the Daily News or the New York Times had to say about what the lawyer said yesterday.
Oh, well, Hugh, well, not only that, but, you know, do you tell your kids, turn the TV off, I can't hear that story? You know, you tell your partner or spouse, get those newspapers off the day, don't want to see them. Those dynamics certainly are there. The pressures are there. But the jurors also know they're the only ones getting the complete story. Everybody else is getting an interpretation biased account.
Well, as the defense and the prosecution, you know, examine the jury, are they examining each other, do you think?
You mean, are the lawyers examining each other?
No, the jurors.
Oh, well, there is a sense to, when jurors get called in the room, you know, they know that some will make it and some won't. Lawyers actually have to be careful of a dynamic. The systems are different around the country. And so in some places, a group of jurors are sort of together until they eventually find their way onto a trial over a period of time. When lawyers do become aware of bonds or strengths between jurors and they want to dismiss one of them and not the other one, sometimes it is a dynamic that they have to deal with because there's a sense of you're taking my friend away. You know, I'm upset. Now they get over it. But absolutely, the lawyers need to step inside the experience and understand what's going on.
Our guest is Paul Lisnek. He's the author of The Hidden Jury. We're talking about juries today, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Don on the phone. Don's with us from Miami, Florida.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a jury foreman on two juries. One was a murder case. Another was a personal injury case. The murder case went quite smoothly, and the evidence was clear, and it was a unanimous decision for conviction. But in the personal injury case, a very unusual thing happened just before the last day of the trial and our jury deliberation. In this injury case, this poor black woman was in an accident. She had a back injury.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence that was brought to us seemed to show that there may be some kind of shady dealings going on in this woman's case.
So somebody else may have been at fault.
Well, no, that she was claiming injury when there actually wasn't one.
Ah, okay.
And so the day before the last day, I had gotten on the phone with my boss, who was asking me how much more time the case would take so I could get back to work. And I had mentioned to him, you know, that it was a personal injury case involving this accident and insurance claim. And now you'll have to bring it back.
I have to bring it back. Go ahead. Finish up the story. That's all right.
I'm sorry. FedEx was just here. And
I hate it when they show up on time.
Okay. Anyway, he said that in his part-time work as a nurse, he worked at this hospital where there was a doctor that had a reputation in the hospital
and for personal
shady dealings with insurance claims.
And it turned out the same doctor.
And so he told me about this, and I was sitting listening, and then he told me the name of the doctor. He said, you know, that this doctor had a nickname in the hospital, and that everybody was joking about it.
So it turned out to be the same doctor.
It turned out to be the same doctor. And so the next day, the trial finished up, and we went to deliberations, and I purposely didn't want to introduce this inside information because it wasn't part of the evidence. And as it turned out, all of the black jury members wanted to vote in favor of this woman and give her a money award. And they were pretty stuck on this.
And you're going to have to wrap up the story
quickly. It got to the point where I felt I had to give out this inside information, and I did it, and that swayed those jury members to go against.
And let me ask Paul Lisnek, that's one thing you're really not supposed to do, is it?
Well, I've got to be honest, yeah. Don bringing that information in from outside the trial is, you know, we're supposed to bring in our common sense. We're not supposed to bring in outside information or evidence. You know, I understand the pressure he felt to do it, but that would not have been the proper thing to do according to the system. That could absolutely lead to a mistrial.
So did you ever tell anybody outside what happened, Don?
Outside of the case?
Yeah, I mean, outside the people in the jury room.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've told my friends,
but
know,
it hasn't come back in any way.
About this afterwards, after the case was over.
All right.
I've mentioned it, but this was many years ago, about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And thanks. I've always wondered whether, you know, I had done the wrong thing or not, but I just felt at the time compelled, because I felt that the information was valid.
Well, Don, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. We're going to be back and wrap up our conversation on this when we come back from the break. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, from town hall meetings to homeowners associations, a look at how communities are governed at the local level and the flagging interest in local politics. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about the to and fro inside a jury deliberation, this following the theatrics in the Tyco case, which is in New York, where the CEO, former CEO of Tyco, Dennis Kozlowski, and former finance chief Mark Swartz are on trial for swindling the company out of hundreds of millions of dollars. One juror apparently threw a gesture of approval toward the defense table at one point, and there was motions for a mistrial, and all that's going on. The jury is now back deliberating, apparently in good faith, but we're talking about the dynamics of jury deliberations. Our guest from our bureau in Chicago is Paul Lisnek. He's a jury consultant and the author of The Hidden Jury, and let's get another caller on the phone. This is Flora, who's with us from Miami, Florida.
Hi.
I
thought that I wanted to tell you my story because this was really so uncomfortable. This was a number of years ago, and it was a federal case, and the witness, the only witness who was pointing his finger at the defendant was a federal informer who had a long criminal record himself, and this was obviously helping his getting out of his criminal career. And two people felt that this guy was innocent. I was one of the two, and the rest of the jury just went along with everything this fellow said. And I was, fingers were pointing. They made you, they actually made us practically in tears, made us feel terrible that we were holding out. It was became a very personal thing. I was completely intimidated. And if there had not been another person who went along with my thinking, I probably would have caved in like that other guy did a few phone calls away. It was a very frightening experience.
Did you at any time think about sending a note to the judge?
No. And now that I know more about it, I think I would. This was a few years ago, and this was my first federal case, and I had been on other juries before, but they were civil and local, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have. However, I think that it came out all right as far as I was concerned, because they could not sway the two of us that this guy was guilty.
And so it was eventually found to be a mistrial.
I'm sorry that I can't recall that at the end.
Well, if you didn't reach a verdict, then it was a mistrial.
Yeah, it wasn't whatever the amount of people. We were not all against him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really frightening.
And, Paul, does that sound familiar, the frightening, the intimidating? That seems to
be... Finger-pointing.
Yeah, finger-pointing. Does that sound familiar, Paul?
Well, people are... I certainly respect the reactions that any juror has inside the process. And, you know, if you put... where's this caller? Where do you live? Where did this
Miami,
take...
Miami, Florida.
Miami, okay. You know, down in Miami, I'm going to be a little stereotypical here, but you have a lot of folks from the East Coast. You have a lot of the New Jersey, New York influence.
The people that were especially strong were the people who were new arrivals, newly made citizens. They were very, very uprighteous in their thinking, and they were not thinking in a democratic way. I can't say that anybody from the East Coast was offensive.
Okay. Well,
I'm a Midwesterner, you can
No, see I appreciate that, as am I. And my point simply is this, that I guess what I'm really referring to is that the personality dynamics, which of course do reflect on our life experiences, our backgrounds, our nationalities, our, you know, all those kinds of makeups come into play. You say new citizens from other countries. I don't know, we want to get into all those details, but I think that's the bottom line.
But maybe they thought because the government said it was so, it had to be so.
And you
there
get...
was no question. That was so.
Yeah.
And I did question it. Hmm. And this other person questioned it.
Well, and that's what, and by the way, you guarantee you that there were lawyers, the defense lawyers, very happy that there were jurors who, when they put them on there, probably sensed, would be skeptical of the government's position. And of course, the government is looking for jurors who are going to be, who are not going to be swayed by people who you know, will argue that the governments do the wrong things. That's the whole idea of jury selection, jury dynamics.
And this was a drug case, and it's so easy to say the guy was a drug carrier, but the evidence just didn't point to it, except that this one man said so.
Flora, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
I appreciate it.
By the way, Neil, can I just very quickly?
Yeah.
You know, remember that she's talking about a criminal case, and so where she's right, in a criminal case, the burden is much heavier than it is in a civil case. Some of the callers have called about civil cases. So, you know, there, the burden of the prosecution was to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, much heavier burden than in a civil case, where the jurors have to simply decide who's more right than the other side.
Now, what about the question, could she have sent the judge a note, even if she wasn't the foreperson?
Oh, absolutely. You know, over the years, things have changed. It used to be jurors couldn't take notes, jurors, you know, there were things. And finally, the system has sort of woken up to the fact that jurors need help to process all this information. So judges are more open now to allowing jurors to take notes, although they don't let them bring them home or take them with them at the end of the trial. And as far as sending the judge a note during the proceedings, if Flora, you know, and other jurors felt intimidated by, and I don't know what other jurors were saying or mm-hmm. I doubt they were accusing her of anything, but, you know, somebody could be afraid to do that, you know, a case that involves mob activity or something like that. You know, it's not unrealistic. Jurors are afraid to serve in those kinds of murder case situations. They get very their minds get very inventive about what the possible consequences could be.
If this case does string out, one person, as it appears to be, holding out for acquittal and refusing to give in, can the judge remove her from the panel and insert one of the alternate jurors?
You know, what a great system we would have if we didn't like what one juror was doing, get rid of them and put somebody else in. You know, the alternate jurors were released in this case as soon as the jury went back to deliberate. The game was over, if you will, about changing jurors at that point. You may remember back to the old O.J. days. By the way, there was a juror on that case who I remember giving a signal to O.J. I saw that as I sat in the courtroom, that same kind of OK signal. Mm-hmm. Nobody seemed to pick up on it. They ultimately did get rid of him, claiming he had a book deal, even though he never did. But the point of it is that any kind of misconduct has to generally happen before they go off to deliberate. Once they do, alternate jurors are sent home. This is the jury that's got to do it one way or the other.
Maybe he just had writer's block.
Anyway, that could be.
Paul Lisnick, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Paul Lisnick is a trial lawyer and the author of The Hidden Jury. He joined us from our bureau in Chicago.